I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Call me Snake.
The blackest eyes. The devil's eyes. Purely and simply evil.
You're out of your mind,
Wang. God bless you.
What do we do?
Hello out there and welcome back to Precinct 13, a podcast about the movies, music, and mind of John Carpenter. My name is Nick Rocco Scalia, one of your two co-hosts, joined as always by your other co-host, Chris Oliphant. Hey, Chris.
Hi, Nick. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm a little sad that we're not talking about The Thing anymore, but I think we covered it. We have to move on. That's with John Carpenter's filmography, like with life. Eventually, you have to just sort of put the past behind you and move forward into the future.
Indeed, this is true.
So we are moving on to Carpenter's 1983 film Christine, which we talked about a little bit on the last few episodes, just in terms of why he did this movie and where he was at in his career and how his adventures and I guess we could say maybe misadventures with The Thing led him down some interesting paths, maybe not exactly the path that he wanted to be on. But to discuss this film, which is an adaptation of a novel by Stephen King, we've got another guest star on the show. I'd like to welcome Josh Mosley to the show. He is a Stephen King aficionado as well as a Carpenter fan. Welcome, Josh.
Hi, Nick. Thank you. You know, longtime listener, first time contributor here. So
yeah.
Thanks for having me on.
We're very glad to have you. Your wife, Megan, did a couple of episodes with us. So you two are now the first couple of Precinct 13, which is, it's an honor. I hope you got the gift basket. I left it with Chris and it was up to him to give it to you. So if you didn't, he's hoarding it. There was some cool stuff in there. So
I really appreciate it. There was a lot of H2R merchandise, which I think is solely directed toward Megan. But, you know, I'm glad we've got that distinction to be the first couple of your podcast.
She is a big H2O fan, maybe the biggest I've ever come across.
Yes. Yes, she is.
She actually got us both thinking about, like, maybe we should see this movie, this sort of lost chapter of a franchise that's already been rebooted so many times. That's something that we maybe need to revisit at some point.
She definitely loves it just slightly more than I do. But
okay.
It's worth a viewing, and I'm sure at some point she will host a viewing for as many fans of your podcast as she can.
Nice. I hope I can make it to that. Well, we brought you on the show. Well, one, just because we appreciate you being a listener and we love having a guest, but also Chris tells me you are a fairly well-versed Stephen King fan, so tell me a little bit about your history as a fan of Stephen King's writing. You know, how did you come into the world of Stephen King? What's some of your favorite stuff, and how do you feel about some of the various adaptations over the years? Because there's been more than we could ever possibly count or talk about on one podcast, but what do you like?
This is quite the dissertation-like question that you're asking, so let me start with this. I am a gigantic Stephen King fan. I have a cousin who kind of introduced me into Stephen King when I was young. Growing up with when I was born versus my formative years and my middle school years, I kind of hit his second wave of his career after the car accident, sort of when he was in the body morphic, let's focus on body horror era, which probably isn't necessarily his high point, but Dreamcatcher and books like that kind of got me into him. And then my love of horror kind of just helped develop that. And then it just has spawned into, that is one thing that I do. Chris has his vinyl collection. For me, it's, if I'm at used bookstores, I'm always looking for first edition hardcover Stephen King. I keep a running list on my phone of, like, these are the ones that I still need. So anytime I come across them, I'm always looking for them. I'm trying to build the complete collection. Adaptation wise, Chris and I have this conversation maybe once a week.
Yeah.
And our answers always vary. But I think when you're looking at what is the most perfect Stephen King adaptation, it's hard to go against Misery. Just because that book is written as a two-person play. It was filmed beautifully. The acting is incredible, but you know, I've got a soft spot for the Shawshank Redemption. I think that's one of the most perfect movies ever made in hindsight when I look back at it.
That was number one on the user list on IMDb for the longest time. I don't even know if that list exists anymore, but of their top 250, just based on user ratings, that was always in that number one slot. And yeah, I mean, it's the rare adaptation that I think takes, you know, it's maybe not his most memorable short story, but the movie version of it is certainly epic and really had a lot of, you know, just added to it a lot, and it, like, it was perfectly made for the screen. I would agree about Misery also. I believe that's written by William Goldman, one of the great screenwriters of all time. Princess Bride, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, you know, like his talent and Stephen King's together, I think went together really well. I mean, it's almost a joke, right? It's almost a cliche to say, well, the Stephen King movies are never as good as the books, but there actually have been some really good adaptations, and, you know, even some of the TV stuff. Like, it's been a while since I've seen The Stand, the miniseries from when I was a kid, but the original It miniseries I think is very good and really captures a lot of the spirit of that book, and The Stand, I remember it being that way also. You were talking about collecting the hardcovers. Do you have the edition of The Stand where it's like, it's massive? I remember seeing it in stores when I was a kid, just this like monster tome of a book, and there's like two kind of like mythical figures like fighting on the cover of it. Do you have that edition of it? Is that the one I'm thinking of? Is that the first edition?
That is the one you're thinking of. It's not the first edition. It's the first edition of the uncut and unedited edition.
Okay.
So whenever they re-released it and expanded it for about, that one clocks in at over 1,000 pages, I think. That's when it got expanded. And what you're thinking of is there's the black figure, the Grim Reaper like with the scythe, and then the white figure with, I think, the sword kind of going at it.
Yeah, I've seen that. Yep.
And also, Nick, don't sleep on, if you're going to talk about Stephen King miniseries, the original Salem's Lot, that miniseries is underrated, I think, in how good that one is.
I have only seen clips of it, the famous clip where the vampire is rising up outside the window, and that is incredibly creepy for a TV movie from the 70s, and I've never actually read Salem's Lot either. I would consider myself a pretty big Stephen King fan. I've been through, I'd say I've read about 3/4 of his stuff, but there's definitely some corners of that very, very large body of work that I haven't gotten to, and that's definitely one of them. You reminded me of that edition of The Stand and just seeing that as a kid, and just the fact that it's this massive book, and it's that really evocative cover art, and I just remember thinking, I mean, I was too young to read it at that point, but it was like, what is this thing? You know, this must be like the most epic story ever told. And like, kind of it is. So I was not wrong about that, but it was like, you know, who are these two things on the cover? What are they supposed to represent? Is this just a story about some mythical battle that's like 1,000 pages long? I get why you'd want to own that. I loved sort of novel artwork, cover artwork from the early 80s and, you know, sci-fi and horror from that time. You don't really see that as much anymore, those beautiful sort of painted covers and all that amazing artwork. So welcome to the show again. We definitely need to move on to Christine. I will ask, though, what is your favorite work by Stephen King? What is the best thing that he has ever done as a writer? Never mind the many adaptations.
If you consider the entire Dark Tower saga as one work, I think it's hard to look past the Dark Tower because that's always kind of been his collective mindset, and all of the books kind of stem from the Dark Tower. If you don't count that and you just want individually, I think I would have to say The Stand is probably my favorite overall.
Both good choices. I definitely would count The Dark Tower, and it's some of my favorite stuff of his. It's him cutting loose in a way that you don't see him doing in other things. And, you know, as much as he's known as the sort of mainstream horror author guy, the sort of epic fantasy world, I think he works really well there, too. And there are some horror elements to it, but also it does have that real Tolkien kind of sweep to it. And funny enough, I've never finished the series. I've read, I think, you know, seven even of eight. I have one more to go, and I don't know. It's like I'm almost saving the last one because I don't want that story to be over. And I know he's kind of continued it and done some other things. So that's just me being, you know.
So the wind through the keyhole is the one that you haven't read.
No, the Dark Tower, the last of the original series that I got as far as that. And I never read that. I think Song of Susanna is the last one I did and loved it. So I should probably finish that series. That's totally a deficiency on my part, but, I guess that's another discussion for another day. I would almost do a podcast just on that. I mean, there's been some adaptations of that also. Was hoping to see the Amazon series, and I believe that's canceled at this point. Was so excited to see Idris Elba play the gunslinger. And he was fine, but the movie was kind of mediocre and not very exciting. So I hope that actually gets its due on screen someday. So that is sort of the mission laid out in front of us tonight. You know, as fans of Carpenter's early work, he takes on this project, Christine. Interesting little tidbit about it was Stephen King at the time, biggest author in the world, essentially, and is basically selling the rights to the stuff he's doing before the books even get published. And that was true of Christine. The producer, Richard Kobritz, gets a hold of Cujo and Christine. I like Cujo a lot, as much of a dog person as I am, and as much as I don't like the idea of the dog being the villain of the book, that's a pretty good one, and the movie's actually pretty good also. But they kind of come together as a package deal, and he decides that Christine is the one that he wants to make. Carpenter has recently lost his opportunity to direct Firestarter, which ended up going to Mark L. Lester, and after the sort of debacle that was the box office reception of The Thing, he lost a chance at another Stephen King property, but kind of bounced right back and got on one that was a fairly successful movie. So we are going to just listen to a little bit of the trailer for Christine, and then it's time to see whether Carpenter was able to bring this vision to the screen. And I guess, you know, we should probably talk about how good of a work of Stephen King this is, and whether it was worth doing in the first place. So we will be right back to get into it with Christine.
She is seductive. She is passionate. She is possessive. She is pure. Evil. She is Christine, a 1958 Plymouth Fury, possessed by hell. Her previous owner is not alive to warn her present one. Once she lures you behind the wheel, you will be hers, body and soul.
All right, we are back, ready to kick off our discussion of John Carpenter's Christine from 1983. Once again, an adaptation of a Stephen King novel that had not even been published by the time the rights to this film were sold. And I think that speaks a lot to who Stephen King was at the time, and just the sort of voracious appetite for projects that had his name attached to them. So does one of you guys want to tell us what this movie is about and basically give us the kind of 30-second elevator pitch for what Christine is?
I mean, I can give it a go here. I think the tagline says it all. How do you kill something that can't possibly be alive?
Oh, Chris, I thought there's another tagline. See, all of these Carpenter movies, like, they have a great tagline, and then they have, like, some pretty good ones to go along with it. The one that I saw that I really liked was Body by Plymouth, Soul by Satan.
Oh, that was so much better.
Much like Man is the Warmest Place to Hide for The Thing, I guess that probably, you know, they could imagine that certain audience members wouldn't get that, but that just, you know, I'm a car guy. I love the sort of that era of American auto building. So I thought that was just such a perfect little tagline for this movie. But anyway, Chris, go ahead. Sorry. Yeah, I had to bring that up.
No, it's fine. I mean, the movie basically follows the story of this super awkward and nerdy teenager, Arnie Cunningham. And his only friend, who's this super popular jock guy, Dennis. And, one day, out of nowhere, they're driving around, and Arnie spots this old Cadillac.
It's a 1958 Plymouth, Chris.
Plymouth Fury, got it. And basically, he just, like, gets totally obsessed with this jalopy of a vehicle to the point where he purchases it and the car kind of like possesses him as he starts fixing it up. And he goes from being, he transforms as a person from this, you know, kind of nerdy outsider into a just sort of a really mean-spirited, evil person. So there's this connection between him and the car, and his friends start to figure out that his obsession with the car is beyond unhealthy.
And the car kills people.
And the car... yeah, and the car... this car has a history to it. I know they get deeper into it in the book, but we do learn that some terrible things have happened to people that have owned the car in the past. So the car is just possessed.
Essentially. Yeah, and basically, and Josh, that's one of the reasons why I'm glad you've read this book and have read it recently. I know there's some major changes in the backstory in the novel to the film. The way the film opens up, I love the opening scene here, by the way. It's one of my favorite things in the movie is this montage of a Detroit assembly line. Like I was saying, I mean, I just sort of like that stuff in movies anyway. I loved seeing all that in Ford v. Ferrari that came out last year. So I'm in for a car movie, regardless if the car is possessed by some evil forces or not. I just like a good car flick. And we've got George Thorogood and the Destroyers, bad to the bone, soundtracking basically the assembly line where this car is built. And in the movie, you know, I think it's very quickly established that this car has just sort of got a problem, right? Like we're seeing these like kind of bland beige-ish colored Plymouth cars coming down the assembly line. And then we got this cherry red, really beautiful, really just hot looking car. And almost immediately it starts wreaking havoc on everyone who touches it. You know, it severely injures a worker at the plant, and then it actually kills the next person who dares to open the door and get inside. So,
well, let's be fair. He, you know, he ashed his shithead right on the shotgun.
On that beautiful upholstery. Yeah. So, I mean, it's just kind of defending itself, right? Just like the alien in the thing was just trying to get home, trying to find a warm place to stay on its journey back into the cosmos. Yeah, this car is just protecting its own inner beauty and everything like that. But tell me a little bit about, Josh, the way that's different from the novel that Christine is based on.
The novel doesn't necessarily cover that as it was built, it wreaked havoc in that. That was kind of added there. And I, Nick, I cannot agree more. My first note here on my beautiful tea party notepad with the teapots and the butterflies that I took this on. it's Megan's. My first note there is just what a beautiful intro. I thought that was absolutely a beautiful shot as they're coming down the line. And you're right. Christine stands out from the beginning. And that was such a wonderful shot.
That song is such a cliche, right? Like we've heard Bad to the Bone like millions upon millions of times, but for some reason, I think this movie uses music exceptionally well, and I want to get into that a little bit later, but
that's, you know, definitely its redeeming quality here is the song selection and what's going on when they happen.
Yeah.
Wonderful tracks.
Yeah. And what a perfect choice that is. You know, yeah. I guess I've gotten sick of that song over the years because it is kind of such a cliche, and you know, if you're going to do anything like this, you're probably going to have that there, but I think it just works really well here and kind of, you know, it puts you in the mood for this movie that is ostensibly a horror movie. It's kind of a high school movie. It's not a comedy, but it's also not taking itself like really, really seriously. You know, you look at a Carpenter film like Halloween, and there's a sort of integrity to the behavior in that movie. And although you can have fun with Halloween, I feel like Christine is a little, it's pitched a little bit more at that sort of fun level. You know, there's nothing so horrifying here that you're going to have nightmares about it. A lot of the killings are characters that we actually want to see killed. So, you know, we have a good reason to root against them. It does go a little bit over the top with the silliness in some ways. And I think that song, you know, it's kind of like this badass sounding song that also has a little bit of a cheesy edge to it. And I think it's just a really nice, like, thematic addition to this movie. I think it really sets the tone for it really well.
Well, you know, I think we'll probably end up talking about probably every song that's featured. So don't sleep on the very beginning song, which as the intro is going and leading into that first kill is Not Fade Away.
Yeah.
Which the lyrics to that match perfectly with the way that it it takes over Arnie and the way that it took over LeBay. Like, it's just, you know, our love will not fade away.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess we should probably get into that now. I mean, I said we weren't going to talk this through like beat by beat, and we started right at the beginning. But one of the things I absolutely love about this movie, and definitely something that I'm sure Carpenter had a pretty big influence on, him being a music guy himself, is this movie likes to juxtapose this very sort of upbeat, kind of sappy 50s rock and roll music with violence and fear and possession and all this sort of dark stuff. And I love that counterpoint that it has. You know, every time Christine kills, the radio comes on and we hear one of these 50 songs, and I'm just looking at the soundtrack list right now, and it's like kind of a who's who of that era of music. You've got, as you were saying, Buddy Holly with Not Fade Away. You got Little Richard, Dion and the Belmonts. You know, it's this kind of rock doo-wop, like this very, very sort of quintessentially Americana kind of music, and it's all this like very upbeat, very romantic, very chaste kind of music. You know, if there's any sexual metaphors in those songs, they're really well hidden. They're really sort of innocent sounding. I actually didn't know. I mean, to just sort of reveal some of my ignorance about this movie, I thought this was a period piece. I always assumed that because I knew the car was a 50s vintage car, I actually thought this movie was set in high school in the 50s, and the characters were, you know, like teenagers in the 50s rather than 70s teenagers for whom all of this stuff is already kind of kitsch and already kind of vintage. We don't really hear any modern music in this movie except for Bad to the Bone, which the characters don't hear, but generally what we're listening to along with them is this 50s rock and roll music. And you know, as Arnie becomes more and more possessed by the car, he becomes more and more like this 50s kind of greaser badass guy, starts doing his hair totally that way, starts dressing like it with a leather jacket and stuff like that. But you were saying, just to get back to this, you were saying that in the novel we don't get that amazing scene on the assembly line. So how do we know, like, where is it sort of introduced in the book that that this car is bad news in some sense?
It begins a lot of the ways that the movie does when the characters develop it. So the novel itself is in three separate pieces, as King likes to do. So the first book, if you will, is from Dennis's perspective. And that leads up until his accident or his injury on the football field. And then the second one kicks into Arnie. And then the third one is kind of not from Christine's point of view, but it's based around Christine, and it kind of goes more back towards Dennis. So you first kind of notice stuff's not right with Christine as soon as Arnie falls in love with it. And Dennis, so one of the major changes that I can't wrap my head around in the movie is that LeBay in the movie is the brother who's selling the car because, you know, he's like, oh, my brother just died a couple of weeks ago and I'm trying to get rid of this. But in the book, it's LeBay, and I'm mixing up their names here. Is the dead brother George?
George is the one who sells him the car in the movie.
Okay, so the brother of George LeBay in the book was the one that sold it, and he's the one that used the term, like, those shitters and all of this that Arnie later adopts. Yeah. So it's almost like in the book, he's morphing into whatever evil thing that LeBay became while he owned Christine. And from the very beginning, Dennis is like, I don't know about this thing. There's something wrong with it. Arnie will get you a new car. Your parents will buy you a new car. And Arnie is just head over heels in love with it from the beginning. And then from there, it develops. He meets, so LeBay in the book, the one that sells it, dies relatively soon after selling it. And that's when you meet the brother who, you know, in the movie sells the car. But the brother comes in and he kind of gives Dennis this background because Dennis is like, I don't know what's going on with Arnie. This car seems a bit strange to me. And the brother's like, well, I'll tell you the backstory. And that's when he gives kind of the evil history of Christine as it's affected their family, because his brother was the first to own Christine.
It seems like kind of some major changes that are made there.
Oh, yeah.
It's
yeah.
interesting. Chris, you've read it too, right?
Yeah, I just actually wanted to chime in and point out that when I started my obsession with Carpenter, if you will, about 2 years ago now, I read the book Christine because I had never read it before. I never had any interest in reading it. I was just like, oh, that's the car one or whatever, you know? And after I saw the movie, so I did this in reverse order. Josh just read the book and then watched the movie. I saw the movie first and then read the book. The book is unbelievable. I mean, I know Josh has, we've had this conversation. He thinks it might be a little bloated. I mean, like a lot of King stuff is, but the book was really powerful. I thought the character development was great. It was scary. It's a page turner. I mean, I recommend it. I think it's a great book.
Yeah, I'm actually going to have to check it out. I think, you know, one of the things we don't get enough of in the movie is Stephen King is known as kind of the nostalgia guy, and he writes about these previous eras in American history, like when he was a kid, when he was growing up. There's always a sort of coming of age aspect to a lot of Stephen King work. You know, I mentioned It, things like that really do that well. And I thought there'd be a little bit more of that in the film. So I guess, you know, you telling us, Josh, about how there are whole sections of the book from Dennis's perspective and things like that. Like, it's not bad here. You know, the script by Bill Phillips, who went on to do like a lot of TV movies. I mean, he's a fairly prolific writer. I think he puts together a fairly tight screenplay for this. And you know, it's a fairly long movie. It's an hour and 50 minutes, but the pacing is pretty good. And there's not a lot of fat on this movie. But I would love to see maybe just a little bit more. I mean, we don't get a lot of, you know, supporting characters. We don't get a lot of kind of high school day-to-day stuff. Like Dennis has some buddies, like some football friends in this movie that we see in like two scenes, and then they're just kind of gone. Their relationship to Arnie is like non-existent, essentially, even though they're good friends with this guy who is Arnie's best friend. So I guess my question about this adaptation is, are we missing a lot of that? Like in the novel, do we get a lot of kind of the backstory between Arnie and Dennis and why these two sort of wildly mismatched best friends are best friends? Is that something that the film doesn't really get across?
Yes and no. So you mentioned the football buddies and how they're kind of just, what is their connection to Arnie? There is no connection to Arnie. Arnie only has Dennis in this world. I think the book, the actual opening line of the book is extremely, I think, important, where Dennis says, "This is the story of a lover's triangle. I suppose you'd say Arnie Cunningham, Lee Cabot, and of course Christine, but I want you to understand that Christine was there first. She was Arnie's first love, and while I wouldn't presume to say for sure, I think she was his only love." And then he goes into saying, you know, "But I was there first, and this is my story." And so Arnie is the loser. He connects the Dennis. Dennis has his connections. But the book itself, the actual question you ask, the answer to that is yes. We miss a lot of what makes Dennis and Arnie special, because while this movie is like the Cliff Notes version of Christine, mm-hmm. and even though it's an hour and 50, it's still so rushed. That was one of my big complaints, is just how rushed the story feels. From he gets the car, everyone hates the car, Dennis is in the hospital,
yeah,
everyone's dead. Like it misses that connection of like Arnie is the perennial loser, and I feel like that's kind of glossed over here. One of my notes that I have, I'm like, Arnie's too hot. Like, he's supposed to be this pimple-ridden loser. I mean, even later on when he says, you know, what is it about Christine? He says, that's the only thing I've ever seen uglier than me. And I'm looking at this actor like, bro, you're kind of beautiful.
Yeah,
you
Keith
know?
Gordon, like, man.
Keith Gordon's yeah. not a bad-looking guy. I mean, John Stockwell is an exceptionally good-looking guy. Went on to be in Top Gun. So, you know, he is. Yeah. He's got that real all-American sort of look. But yeah, I mean, not being very familiar with that story, I was like, okay, so you got this friendship between the biggest nerd in school and kind of the jock, all-American football guy that everybody likes. And so I guess my assumption was, you know, they must have grown up together and were best friends in grade school. And Dennis kind of just keeps him on as a friend, because Dennis this is a pretty good person.
They do that, and they work together. A big part of the book in the beginning is that they work together, and, you know, he sees Christine when they got off. So.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it's definitely something. It's a very visible loss, I think, that you get in this movie. And it's kind of just it's a fun dynamic that doesn't really get explored here at all. And yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think Keith Gordon's very good in this movie, but it's the same problem that all these high school nerds in movies have, is that, you know, all you got to do a little bit of polish and they are beautiful Hollywood people. They are not like the actual nerds that, like, you might have gone to school with yourself. So you got to suspend your disbelief a little bit there. It's kind
same of thing you see in a lot of rom-coms.
This girl's
so ugly, you take her glasses off and let her hair down. What do you know?
Yeah.
Rachel McAdams and people like that play those characters, and you know, they're mind-blowingly gorgeous normally, and they don't do a great job of kind of uglying them up. You know, the other point that sort of strikes me just in talking about those two characters is that I don't really know whose movie this is. You know, it is kind of in some sense Arnie's movie, because Arnie is the one that possesses Christine and then becomes possessed by Christine. But Dennis is kind of the protagonist. I mean, by the end of the film, he is our hero. He is the one that sort of defeats the ultimate evil in this story. You almost have like a split protagonist kind of thing between these two characters, because after a while we can no longer really sympathize with Arnie anymore, and actually it's pretty quick that I think that happens. Like, once he gets the car, he becomes less and less sympathetic and less likable very, very quickly, and Dennis kind of becomes both the hero and the audience surrogate. Like, we think we are supposed to really sympathize with Arnie, and after a while we can't really do that anymore. I do sort of like the idea, and I'm sure this is done even better in the book, that Dennis would be the villain in a lot of other movies like this, you know, the all-American high school football jock guy. Sometimes that is the main bully. Sometimes that's the one that we're supposed to hate. And actually, no, he's a pretty normal, down-to-earth guy, and he is the hero of the story. He wants what's best for everyone, and he definitely wants what's best for Arnie. The opening line of the book is kind of interesting, because that's kind of sour grapes on his part, right? Because he does try to hook up with Lee, so that's a little bit of jealousy. I mean, we don't even really see that get played out much. You know, he kind of hits on her early in the movie and gets shot down, but
they end up together in the book.
Yeah, I assume they do in the movie, too. Like, we don't see it, but by the end, they look like they're getting kind of romantic. They've been through some stuff together, so...
Yep.
I'd like to point out, I love how the movie cues us to how much of a dork Arnie is, that right at the beginning of the movie when he gets picked up by Dennis, and he's like, he's running out of the house with this giant garbage bag that just like pops open and there's garbage everywhere. And then his mom's like, oh, it's okay, I'll take care of it. And he runs through this massive puddle, forgets his lunch, turns around, runs back through the puddle, gets the lunch, runs back through the puddle again. It's so over the top, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much in this movie that's like that. I mean, I think everything with Arnie's parents is kind of pitched at that level, right? Like, they're almost a joke. They're almost comedic characters. It never quite tips over into just outright comedy. But yeah, they are they are kind of one-dimensional, and they're a little bit silly.
Yeah, I'm imagining the scene he talks about in the car where they were playing Scrabble together and arguing about using the word ratio or fellatio.
Fellatio, yes.
I mean, this movie, the first dialogue they have is just like, Dennis is like, you know, man, we're going to be seniors this year. You should think about getting laid. I mean, it's just like, wow.
Yeah, and that there's the one girl who has a mustache, and he's like, well, I can't have sex with her because she's got a mustache. I'm like, all right, beggars can't be choosers, I guess. Whatever.
Yeah, there's a lot of sexual tension in this movie right off the bat, I think.
There is. There's no sex in it. You know, it is, much like those 50 songs that we were talking about, it is very chaste in some ways, but, you know, these are all-American, red-blooded high school kids. I mean, sex is definitely going to be on their minds. Interesting thing about Keith Gordon's performance, which I think adds a whole new layer of creepiness weirdness to this whole thing. I read it after I saw the movie. I wish I hadn't. I wish I had read it before. But he basically says, you know, in the scenes where he's alone with Christine, where it's just him in the car, he was imagining that Christine was a woman. And he always had an idea of, like, what part of a woman he's touching when he's, like, you know, running his fingers across the steering wheel or whatever. You know, we get a lot of shots like that in the film. And that adds to the horror and the revulsion and the creepiness a little bit to me.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, Christine ends up being that kind of sexual conquest that he, at the beginning of the film, doesn't think he's ever going to get. And you know, then that becomes actually more important than getting the girl, because he does, and she's beautiful, but still, the car is always more important. You know, if there is, like you were saying, if it is a love triangle, Christine was there first, and Christine is a more desirable partner.
That's right. So I had a question for you guys, because I'm not sure, and I didn't have a chance to research it. But so the Plymouth Fury that he buys from LeBay, George LeBay, correct?
In the movie, Roland is the brother in the book, by the way. Roland LeBay.
Okay, so this old guy in the movie, when I saw him, I said, isn't that the old guy from Home Alone, or am I wrong? The one that Macaulay Culkin's character is so scared of, the old guy with the shovel. Is it the same guy?
You know, I'm going to look it up right now.
If it's not, I looked at this dude and I was like, isn't that the old guy from Home Alone?
That guy is Old Man Marley in Home Alone. His name is Roberts Blossom, which is a great name.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. He's actually doesn't look that much worse for wear in Home Alone. You know, that's these movies are like 7 years apart or something like that. And he just was kind of the quintessential slightly creepy old guy. He passed away in 2011, unfortunately, but you know, was in a number of, he was in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and he's in The Last Temptation of Christ, so definitely worked with some interesting filmmakers.
He worked alongside Scorsese.
Yeah, born in New Haven, Connecticut. I live just outside of New Haven. Oh. I was born there also. So, yeah, Roberts Blossom. But this is the first probably anyone has talked about him. Now the only Home Alone side character that anyone talks about is Donald Trump from Home Alone 2. But
yes.
But there were lots of other interesting people in those movies. Yeah, I actually like that performance. And I think some of the scenes that he's in are some of the most interesting scenes in the movie. The production design of his house and just sort of seeing the car that first time and what a shithole it is and what terrible shape that car is in, and I'm certainly, as much as I love cars and I think it would be really cool to find a vintage car and fix it up like that, I'm definitely with Dennis when he's like, you know, why do you want this thing? This is not worth anything, and you're gonna pay $250 for it, which is a lot of money in the 70s.
We have to talk about that scene. There's a bit to talk about there. I mean, the way that Arnie is, you know, drooling over this car. It's just, it's sort of unbelievable, you know, because Dennis is there talking every single molecule of common sense into him. He's just like, he's like, no, this car is so great. And like, that's when, you know, LeBay comes over and he's like, yeah, like he says, this is when the word shitters starts becoming part of the dialogue in this movie. And the
movie does love the word shitters.
Yeah. And a lot of the things that LeBay says, we notice Arnie starts to say later on as his transformation takes place. But yeah, this whole scene, you know, he's like $300, $250. Well, I'll go get the pink slip, you know, and just the whole, I don't know, the whole transaction scene just I don't think works very well.
But no, but don't forget how he first describes Christine too.
Oh yes, yes.
Because when Arnie gets, he's like, get inside of it. And he's like, oh, man, when this was new, the smell of a new car, it's the finest smell in the world, except for pussy.
Yeah,
which
I mean,
it's such a LeBay quote.
Yes.
Roland in the book, and then it's attributed to George here, but just, it is a sexualized, I mean, Christine is a sexualized movie, it's a sexualized car, it's...
Yeah. Now, that quote is in the book, but the way it's delivered in this scene, it just... Especially if you've read the book,
it doesn't
like,
connect.
It does, yeah.
It's
you're just
awkward.
Like, really? Yeah. And then, of course, later on in the movie, when Arnie's, you know, driving around with Dennis playing chicken on the highway, and he like says that line or something. It's just, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, this is a movie about high school kids, though, and That scene was believable to me, just in the sense that you're so wide-eyed at that era in your life, and, you know, cars, girls, all that stuff, like, that's all you think about, you know, football for a character like Dennis. So, I don't know, I think that kind of works for me. I mean, it is, there's definitely, it's not subtle about the sexual metaphors. I mean, this is not David Cronenberg's Crash, where people are actually having sex with cars in the movie, but the car is certainly very sexualized, and like I was saying, the performance, like he's trying to sort of, you know, with his touches and with his looks and things like that. I mean, we are supposed to get that sense out of it. So I don't know. I sort of buy why he wants to have this car, and he's just a little bit more imaginative, I guess, than his good friend Dennis, who kind of has everything that he wants out of life. And Arnie sees this thing that he could turn into that. You know, this is the coolness that he's been looking for all along. And we know he's got some problems with some bullies, Butch and his crew, who are some very stereotypical, like they feel very much like 1950s movie bullies, even though this is made in the 80s, set in the late 70s. They have that kind of greaser sort of look about them. You know, they almost remind me of, like, you know, John Travolta and Welcome Back, Cotter, or something
totally.
Like that.
Totally.
It's the sideburns, the mutton chops, I guess. That,
oh, is this your lunch here? I don't see your name on it. I don't see your name on it. Arnie Cunningham.
It's like, they say that a lot. So I was reading about the film. You know, the violence is not very explicit in this movie. Like we said, there's no graphic sex, but they wanted an R-rated movie. So the screenwriter Bill Phillips was just like, all right, well, I'll just load up the script with lots of fucks and shits and lots of curse words.
Yep.
Using the word cunt in a movie from this era, I was not prepared for that. And, you know, I've known people named Cunningham and certainly called them Cunningham before, but I wasn't expecting to hear that in a movie, particularly from this time period. And I was a little bit taken aback by that. Like, I had always thought this was the kind of movie you could show almost uncut on TV. And certainly you'd have to cut that out.
I like that gang. I love Buddy Repperton. In the book, he's fantastic. Here, I'm like, I'm not really sure about that giant mullet you got going on. But you got Moochie. I mean, they were classic greaser nicknames.
Yeah.
I liked them. They worked for me.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting, though, right? Like, this movie is, like I said, it is set in the 70s and it is kind of meant to be a modern story. But there's all these like 50s touchstones and they feel very much like juvenile delinquents from a 50s high school movie, more so than they do, you know, the bullies in like a Revenge of the Nerds or like an 80s movie.
Oh, that's a good one.
That deals with something like this.
I think they feel Revenge of the Nerds like when they're picking on Arnie.
Yeah.
I love when they're holding up his lunch bag and Buddy stabs it with his switchblade, because of course he has a switchblade, because that the thing you have to be that character. And he somehow perfectly punctures some yogurt that's in there and it just like grossly like all spills out. Like he just nails it. It's like a direct hit on the yogurt and the whole thing. It's like it's not even in a container and it just spills out all over the floor.
And at least they made the effort to set that scene up earlier, because his mother tells him to make sure he keeps it cold because there's yogurt in there.
Yeah.
So
like I said, it's a pretty good script. They keep really good track of their yogurt. Absolutely.
Yeah. And Dennis, of course, stands up for him. You know, he's a badass.
Until they snitch on him. And then they just snitch their way into getting him expelled.
Yep. Yeah.
That like shop teacher that we see in that scene, I was expecting him to come back. He doesn't really come back.
No.
He never
comes
back.
That was just for that scene to get Buddy suspended.
Yeah. Enter Lee Cabot here.
The most beautiful girl in the school.
The new girl. It's always the new girl.
Yep. And, I was reading, someone was, who was supposed to play her? There was somebody that they wanted to cast.
Brooke Shields.
Brooke Shields, that's
right.
Yeah,
so originally the plan for this movie was Scott Baio as Arnie, who, you know, people knew from Happy Days, I think, back then, or Joni Loves Chachi, he might have been on both, and then, of course, went on to Charles in Charge fame. So he was a star, and I think it would have been a very different movie. He's kind of, you know, if you think Keith Gordon is a good-looking, very Hollywood kind of guy, I think Scott Baio even more so. And then Brooke Shields is obviously, like, one of the great bombshell actresses of that era. So I think that would have changed things an awful lot. Getting this sort of unknown Alexandra Paul, who then went on to be on like Baywatch and stuff like that. I mean, she kind of
became a sex symbol,
but she wasn't at the time. I mean, she does like the look that she has in this movie is great because she's very pretty, but she also has this kind of girl next door quality. And she's reminds me a little bit of Laurie Strode, right? Like she's the smart kid. We see her reading her history book and being a good student and stuff like that. And you know, she's kind of not willing to go all the way with Artie, and she kind of is ready to call him on his bullshit a lot when they finally get together. So yeah, I like her performance. I like that character, and I think it fits really well. And I like the fact that her and Dennis seem to sort of join forces and then get together at the end.
I think she was definitely a highlight of this movie. She did really well.
Yeah, I thought I read somewhere Kevin Bacon was considering this role, but he turned it down for Footloose.
Mistake. I'm on record. What a mistake.
Yeah, Bacon should have been in Christine all the way. I'm sorry, John Carpenter's Christine. So look, he buys this piece of shit, and he brings it home, and his parents freak out, obviously.
Can we just stop and talk about Regina and Michael, by the way? The college professors, of course they're going to freak out when you bring this thing home.
Yeah, and he's like, you know what, you've never let me do anything on my own in my whole life, and this is something that I want to do, and you just have to deal with it. And so he brings it to this...
Will Darnell's garage.
Will Darnell, yeah, with a giant junkyard in it. And I thought that was really funny. I noticed, what is the line that he says when he pulls the car into the garage? He looks at Dennis. Will Darnell looks at Dennis, and he goes... You should be ashamed of yourself for selling this thing to him, or something, you know. And he's like, I totally tried to talk him out of it.
And he tells him, at least in the book, and I think in the movie, where he says, "You are never to turn this car on again until you have it like up to snuff, because none of us want to die. Like it's just got all that carbon like this thing is a honker."
Yeah, and Will Darnell, whoever plays him in this movie, I don't know off the top of my head, is like the meanest person on the planet, basically.
Robert Prosky, he's like a very famous character actor. I think he has passed away at this point also, but definitely a familiar face from a lot of different 80s movies. I mean, this is Carpenter really, like he's not working with any of his usual people here, right? Like Dean Cundey did not shoot this movie. None of his regular stars. I mean, there's roles for all of them here. Like I could have squeezed Charles Cyphers in here somewhere and you know, I could have found some room for all the Carpenter regulars, but we don't get any of them. You know, Austin Stoker could have been in this. Instead, we get kind of these great character actors like Robert Prosky, like Harry Dean Stanton as Rudolph Junkins, who we've got to talk about a little bit also.
I was just going to say, he was in Escape from New York, though.
Yeah, he comes back. That's right.
He's like the one guy, you know. Yeah.
Do you know why that was? Do you think that was the studio telling him don't use your people, or did like that trope just sit this one out and be like, nah, John, we'll catch you on the flip side.
No, John, we saw the thing. We don't want to work with you anymore, you sick bastard. No, I don't know. I mean, I think it's more a question of he kind of didn't have like a full deck to play with when he was handed this movie. You know, he'd been dealt, as Chris and I were talking about on the show over the last couple weeks, you're only as good as your last film. And while I think his last film, his previous film to this, is his best film, because it was so unsuccessful, because people saw it as just too graphic and too grim and too gruesome, you know, he kind of had to probably make a lot of concessions and just go along with what the studio wanted. I mean, this was a big studio picture too, Columbia Pictures, as it were. And, you know, I don't think he had quite the clout that he had prior to making The Thing. So it was just kind of like, no, this is who we want. And if we're going to get Scott Baio, then damn it, you're going to direct Scott Baio. And turned out that he didn't have to direct Scott Baio. But I think it's actually a good cast. I like all these character actors that sort of populate this world. I mean, none of them really have much to do. Junkins, especially, like, I can imagine him being really important in the book. And he gets, what, like three scenes here? And he's Harry Dean Stanton, so of course he's mesmerizing. And you know what I love about Harry Dean Stanton is he's always a character that's much weirder than he looks on the surface. You know, you can sort of see the wheels turning. You can see that he's eccentric, even if the character, like the character in this movie, doesn't sort of outwardly come off as eccentric. So
he was good. He doesn't have much of a different role than he did in the book. Like, Junkins is kind of just in and out of the book too, like showing up every time there's a death and correctly blaming Christine and by extension Arnie. So I had no problem with any of the casting. I thought everybody kind of was cast pretty well.
Yeah. Yeah. And that character, I think, although we don't see a lot of Junkins, you know, he's just like one of the things that always seems to happen in movies about characters of this age, like particularly horror movies, is the cops are just such a non-entity. Like, you know, they basically, like, there's no cops, there's no parents, and they're just able to go through their business, and people are getting murdered all around them. And a lot of times we don't see kind of the adults, we don't see that perspective. And he does kind of supply that a little bit, because like I said, Arnie's parents are kind of ridiculous, and they become kind of non-factors in the movie. But Junkin is more of a, you know, he's kind of an adult parental figure almost, and he does kind of suspect Arnie right away. And although he doesn't come out and say it right away, you can definitely tell just because Stanton is as good an actor as he is that he has some pretty serious suspicions. And particularly before he understands that something, you know, supernatural is going on, he thinks this kid is a murderer or is capable of being a murderer.
Yep. So Arnie starts, you know, fixing up this car at also what seems to be a supernatural level almost. And this, at some point we learn his mother tells Dennis that, you know, she found out that some terrible things had happened in the car. There was a suicide in the car. And that's, this all happens right around the time where, so he's fixing up the car. We find out that the reason, the connection between why he's so obsessed with it might have to do with the fact that the audience now knows that there's some really messed up things that have happened in this car before. And there's a scene where it's a very important scene in the book as well, is during the football game where, you know, Dennis is like running out. He's like the wide receiver and he's running out to catch this pass. And he looks up and there's Arnie. And all of a sudden, he's just like, you know, making out with Lee, like she's his girl now, and they're leaning up against this pristine Christine.
Pristine Christine. I was like, he's got to go there, right?
He's, I was not like, gonna, he's not going to go the table. There.
Yeah.
It's a pristine Christine, and he just misses the catch.
Yeah.
And
he pulls the car right up to the football field. Like, I don't know, yes, that you can do that anywhere, but I guess, right, the, you know, little bit of dramatic license there. I mean, that football scene is so weird. Like, he's not paying any attention to the ball being thrown at him. And of course, he's then down for the count. We lose him as an active character for a lot of the movie because of that. But yeah, I mean, it's such a, I mean, it almost doesn't really play out in slow motion, but it almost does. Like when he sees his nerdy friend making out with the prettiest girl in school, that's how we know that things have really taken a turn.
Yeah, and he basically suffers a career-ending injury.
Yeah, which he handles very well. Like there's one kind of tearful moment in the hospital where he's like, they told me I may never play football. Or no, they I think they tell him he's never, literally never going to play football.
Yeah, again. He's never going to play football again.
He comes back pretty good. I think he comes back from that better than I would, you know, particularly because that's kind of one of the only things we know about him is that he's a football player. So, you know, there you go. You're a concert pianist and somebody just broke your fingers and you're never going to be able to play the piano again kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think the movie does telegraph pretty well, though. Like, as I think Josh actually hit it right on the head at the beginning, is that especially if you have read the book, and it is, I mean, you're right, it is almost a 2-hour movie, but it does seem kind of rushed, because it's like almost as soon as Lee and Arnie are together, there's a scene where they're at the
the choking scene.
Yeah,
yeah,
where they're at the drive-in, and she's just like, "I think you love this car more than me."
Yeah,
you know,
a lot of that stuff is really kind of spelled out in dialogue, which is never the most fun way to get that stuff across. I will be honest with you guys. I not knowing a lot about this movie, and I don't think I'd ever even seen the trailer before I started watching it. So we get to that scene, and they have the argument in the car, and they've got like some hamburgers wrapped in foil, and she starts eating it, and she starts choking, and he gets trapped outside, and it's this very sort of harrowing scene. And I was like, wait a minute, didn't LeBay's daughter, she choked to death in the car? I was like, is that all this car is going to do? Like, this is just about a possessed car that people choke to death in? And I was like, oh man, if all the kills in this movie are that, this movie is going to be a piece of shit.
This was John Carpenter's response to Mac and Me. He was like, we are not making a McDonald's movie. Everybody dies.
Congratulations. First Mac and Me reference on the show.
Take that, Megan. Nobody cares about H2O.
Oh, no. So, like...
Yeah, so I guess I was very happy because my wife walked in at that point, and she had seen this film before, and my late great mother-in-law, this was a movie that she liked a lot, so I didn't realize Jackie was a fan of Christine, and I was like, this is not a movie where like people just choke to death in this car, right? Because I don't know if I can deal with an hour and 50 minutes of that. I was like, it is going to run people over at some point, isn't it? And she says, yes, don't worry. So
it is a pretty disturbing scene. I mean, it runs. Sure
it is. Sure it is, but I was just connecting that to the backstory of the car, and I was like, so is that its power? Is that all it can do is make people need the Heimlich maneuver while they're sitting inside it?
And it was a great scene, but compared to how that happens in the book, that would have advanced this one just slightly better.
Remind us.
Because the point in the book is they're on that date, he macks on her, and she's like, no, Christine freaks me out, I'm not going to do this here. And then they end up picking up a hitchhiker on their way home, and they stop for burgers, and then she starts choking, and Arnie just basically lets it happen.
Yes, you're
and
right.
Then the hitchhiker has to save her, and that begins to show the descent of Arnie into just the evil that he becomes.
Yeah, because you don't get that at all in the film, because Arnie basically right away is trying to get back in the car. And of course, we get that very cliched shot of the lock coming down so he can't open the door. I mean, we've seen that so many times in films before. And he is making an effort to save her right away, pretty much. And the idea of somebody else doing it while he kind of just looks on, that's a hell of a lot creepier. I agree.
Yeah, that's at that point in the book is that's... slowly starting to see him change, and that's where it's kind of like, you love this more than me, and he's like, no, and then he's almost just letting it happen. And when he does try, the door is locked, or he claims that it is, so they kind of took a little liberty from that. But that scene didn't click with me in the movie as much as I could see it if you've never read the book.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what we're waiting for all along, right, is for something to happen to that gang of bullies. And it definitely does later on. It takes a little while to get to that. I mean, this is not quite as simplistic a movie. I said the plot is simplistic, and I think it is. But, you know, it's not simply he gets this power and he immediately uses it to take revenge on the people who picked on him. You know, that happens, but there's other stuff that happens on the way to that. The midpoint of the movie is where they trash his car, and being the car guy that I am, that scene is almost as hard for me to watch as the stuff with the dogs and the thing. I love cars and I love dogs, and I hate seeing bad things happen to them on screen, and they really wail on this thing. And then we learn later that Moochie took a shit on the dashboard. So.
Yeah, he did. As of course Moochie did. Yeah. That's just a Moochie thing.
Mooch dropping the deuce. I gotta tell you right now, Nick, I couldn't agree more. This last time I was watching it, seeing these guys fuck up that car, man, just broke my heart, dude.
I was like, it's a beautiful car.
God, yep.
And they really wail on it. You know, when I see Buddy with the sledgehammer, I'm like, oh, God, I know where this is going. I don't like it.
Oh, yeah. They're like taking a switchblade to the upholstery and everything.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just
those seats. That...
But you know what? That is such a perfect segue into just... the kills of that gang.
Oh yeah,
that's so great.
Oh, you need so that great scene, and then of course right after that you get that amazing. I mean, the special effects in this film are, I think, very, very good. These practical effects where the car basically rebuilds itself. You know, it's done with like they reverse the footage. I believe it was like vacuum. You know, they had forms and they sucked the air out of them with a vacuum and then played that footage in reverse, and it looks so good. good. We've talked about that so much on the show about movies from this era and those practical special effects, and they really do have that sort of nice tangible quality to them. I watched a nice looking print of this movie, and again, the special effects I think hold up really, really well, and just sort of seeing it come back together. I mean, now you could do that so easily with CGI, but back in 1983, you had to basically do that all via practical effects, and it looks like a real car. I mean, that is very, very well shot, and it's just sort of a really fun, neat sequence that really shows you how powerful this thing is.
Did they not use some of the same folks that they used on The Thing for the effects?
Yeah, I believe the one of the major special effects people from The Thing, I don't have his name in front of me, but he did come back to work on this one. Roy Arbogast is the guy.
Okay, I think I remember that from the bonus features, but yeah, for me, as I was telling Josh before, I mean, this movie's fine for me, and then once it gets to the hour point, then I really enjoy the second half of this movie more than the first half.
Yeah, it's a slow start. It definitely is a slow start. And again, like I was saying, I mean, I was kind of joking about like, oh, is all this car can do is make people choke to death? But like, you know, when you see this car and you just imagine the power of it, it's like, all right, I want to see this thing chase some people down, run some people over, blow some stuff up. And we do get all of that. You know, this movie had a pretty fair budget. And by the time it starts stalking and killing the gang, we really do have that. I mean, the scenes where Christine is on fire, like chasing Buddy down, I mean, that's right there in the trailer. And yeah, that is the image I would use to sell this movie, because that is a great scene. I mean, the payoff of it isn't great, but it's Moochie gets killed in the alleyway, so the car just squeezes its way into the alley and gets closer and closer. That's really cool. And then Buddy, this flaming car, I love seeing that. I mean, it's just such a cool, iconic image, and it's done so well, and obviously it is a real car on fire. I believe they had something like 28 versions of this car in various Plymouths from that area that they used to sort of mock up Christine, and one of them they just straight up set on fire and sent after a stuntman, and it just looks amazing.
Yeah.
That was when I was really
beautifully shot film, yeah.
Yeah.
The gas station exploding and everything is the best. I love Buddy's demise. I like how it all starts off, how Christine is just riding their ass. He's like, oh, give them a taste of their own medicine. And he puts the car in reverse, and Christine is just like reversing with them.
Yeah.
And then when they speed off and they finally get to the gas station, I love how it doesn't just go right to Christine, like plummeting into the station and blowing everything up. Christine literally just wrecks this dude's car so hard. Like, and he's just standing there, you know, with his stupid tire iron or something like that. He's like, come on, get some. And I'm like, dude, you are going down, man. Once the gasoline starts pouring out, and then Christine just basically, you know, just flies right into the garage there, and the whole thing blows up. I love it. And then, you know, we see the car just reverse out, completely engulfed in flames. And that's where it's like, all right, buddy, you know, it's like you're running right down the middle of the road.
Many characters do that in this movie.
They all like, just run down the
jump
street.
Jump over a barrier and you're good to go.
Even Moochie, that car starts coming down that, just hop up on that loading dock.
Yep.
There was that giant ledge.
Yeah. So while those things I overall love both of those scenes.
Well, it looks cool, and really what this comes down to, I mean, this is never meant to be a sort of realistic movie in any way. And I can imagine, you know, Carpenter gets this project and he's reading the script and he's like, oh yeah, I could have some fun with that. That looks like something I want to do.
Yeah, from what I understand, he really, again, we all know the deal here. I mean, he read the script and liked it and decided to do the movie, but I mean, it wasn't a passion project of his by any means.
Did he like it? Did he in fact like that? I thought this was just pure, he needed the money.
No, I mean, he will say that he did it as a job, but he liked it and he was happy with the way the movie came out.
Yeah, I think he was a good choice for the material. I don't know if you know about this, Chris, but did you know he and Tommy Lee Wallace and Nick Castle were in an old-fashioned rock and roll band called the Coupe de Villes?
I did. You sent me the link on that.
Did I send you that? Yeah, because I'm sort of fascinated by that. But obviously, he was a little bit of a car guy himself and kind of liked the culture and liked the era. And, you know, I wouldn't say he's a great rock and roll musician, but definitely has some affinity for the kind of iconography that we see in this movie. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, like not everything is going to be as much a passion project as like The Thing was for him. And even that wasn't as much of a passion project as I thought it was, as we've talked about, but it's a good marriage of director and material. And like I was saying, I mean, there are certain things in this script, like I can imagine reading this as a director and thinking, yeah, all right, you know, all this high school stuff, I can do that. I mean, it's this is shot, I believe, in the same small town in California where they shot most of Halloween, so it's got a little bit of that kind of small town high school Americana feel. I think it's much more evocative in Halloween, but that was something that he had done before and sort of knew that he could handle. And then you get to do these scenes with this flaming car chasing somebody down the middle of the road. How do you say no to that, you know?
So Josh, tell us about, because after these guys get killed by Christine, the I love this scene when Christine goes back to Darnell's garage and it's just this like smoking heap. and Darnell pulls out the shoddy. Explain his death. I think that's a pretty fun part of the movie too.
So Darnell's death, when he dies, I think the best part of that, because Darnell is a relatively large human being, right? That's a fair description of him. And this is what I love so much about the soundtrack, because when he is kind of crushed in that car, it's by am I wrong? It's Boney Maroney, right? By Larry Williams. That's the song that's playing.
Yes.
About a skinny girl. And that's just part of just the irony that happens in this movie and why the soundtrack just connects so well, as he's just dying to this happy skinny girl like song as he's just fat and dying. Like I like Will Darnell. I think he was underutilized in this movie, criminally underutilized.
I actually like him too. Like, Arnie has all these sort of different father figures almost, and he's one of them. Yeah. You know, he's a guy who sort of fulfills a role because Arnie's father's kind of an asshole. So he's this guy that, you know, he's reluctant at first to let him into the garage and to have him there. And then he basically says, well, all right, you can raid my junkyard and, you know, you can work for me and I'll even throw you a few bucks. And, you know, there's a key plot point.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
You know, when Darnell is being killed, Arnie's actually out just running an errand for him. He's going to pick up some parts. So they actually do end up having kind of an interesting relationship.
I love when he's like, well, thank you, I'll have to give it some thought. And he's like, well, don't give it too much thought or I'll kick your ass right out of here.
Yeah. We never actually see the junkyard. The junkyard must be massive because he's able to find like very specific parts for a very specific car pretty easily. So he must just have fields upon fields of junk behind his place there that we don't see.
Yeah, definitely. In the book, that's kind of how Christine regenerates, because part of the plot point is nobody understands when Arnie actually works on this car and does anything worth anything. So at night, Arnie just shows up and just drives Christine around the junkyard, but she magically is getting better.
She just assimilates parts from the junkyard?
It's just the mythical, it's never really explained, but it's just, she just kind of repairs herself.
There's a cool scene where Junkin shows up at the high school, the parking lot of the high school, and Arnie is there. And at that point, he's just in total badass mode. And, you know, he's just very cynical and very, you know, he doesn't really care at all about authority anymore. And, you know, Junkins is sort of asking him about that, about like, well, how is this car, how does this look so good? I saw what it looked like. How did you fix it up so good? And he says, oh, well, you know, look at the paint job there. Like, it's two different colors and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Junkins gets in real close and he looks at it. He's like, no, I can't actually tell the difference. It looks perfect. It looks, once again, pristine.
Yep.
So, you know, I mean, it's very far-fetched as an idea, but at least the film doesn't completely just hand wave it away. We do get like that sort of audience surrogate kind of question, like, you know, how come this thing looks so perfect now?
Yeah, the only thing I didn't like, well, There's a lot, but the scene that I'm thinking of in my head currently is when Arnie's standing there and watching Christine rebuild herself. I feel like that is not in the spirit of what Stephen King was going
He's
for.
He's like, show me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I got to say that, you know, back to Keith Gordon just for a sec here, man. Like, I like watching him become this major asshole because, like, yeah, he becomes less sympathetic, totally, but I felt so bad for him, like, at the beginning of this movie. I kind of like when he's not taking shit from his parents anymore.
Yeah.
There's a scene where his father's like, you've been way too disrespectful, and he just, like, straight up, like, chokes his dad, and he's like, what are you gonna do?
Yeah, he starts, like, throwing around F-bombs, which, you know, you can't even say fellatio in that house, so never mind, fuck.
Yeah, like, I kind of like that. I kind of like how he's showing up as this total greaser when he's, like, visiting Dennis at the hospital, and he's, like, pouring him beers on Thanksgiving, and he's just like, I mean, I don't know, like, it's so over the top, but I like that character. I was just like, it's New Year's Eve. Let's cheers to all the shitters that died in 1979 or something like that. I don't know.
Isn't he saying let's cheers all the shitters that are going to die in 1979? Like, that's the next year. So it's like, oh, he's got some plans already. Him and Christine they're going to have a big year. Yeah, I mean, I agree with you, actually. I mean, it's kind of a simplistic thing, but it works well, and you know, maybe if we got to know him a little bit better before, but I do agree that the first hour of this movie is very slow. I mean, how much character development are you really going to get of Arnie as a bullied nerd? But we do see, and the way the film is cut together, I think, really nicely shows you just the differences. Like, he will be, you know, that much further along from one scene to the next. And when the film really starts to kind of, you know, that, like, one scene there, we get dates on the screen. We get, you know, we see a date in October and then a date in November. And the change is really profound in Arnie. And I do think Gordon actually handles that well. The costuming is perfect. You know, he starts dressing more and more like kind of a 50s greaser car guy. I like all of that stuff. I agree with that.
So where do we go from here? I mean, we're basically like at the end of this movie, and then we should talk about that.
Final battle between Bulldozer and Christine.
Yes, battle between Bulldozer and Christine. Romantic blossoming between Dennis and Lee. And then I did just think, like, overall thoughts on this movie and where it fits into the filmography.
I really like leading up to that scene where Dennis finally decides. So that New Year's Eve drive, that's the scariest scene in the movie to me. Not because anybody dies in that scene, but that's when we really see how far Arnie has come and how obsessed he is and how much he and Christine have kind of become one at that point. So, you know, he's driving really crazy and really erratically and putting Dennis in danger and is, you know, not listening to reason at all. And then Dennis does, I think, the perfect thing, which is key the car, you know, Darnell's tonight, and wrecks the paint job that obviously, you know, Arnie spent a lot of time on there, and he knows that's going to get his attention. And I just, you know, it's kind of a little moment, but I like that. And that
He's not doing that for Arnie, though. He's doing that to challenge Christine.
Sure.
Yeah. And Arnie, I don't think, spent any time on that. That's just Christine repairing herself.
I mean, I'm going to tell you something right now. That scene where Arnie is driving that you were describing as the scariest scene in the movie, that is the epitome of drinking and driving right there.
Yeah.
He is pounding back these beers like there is no tomorrow at like 100 mph.
Yeah, and then he just, like, swerves over into the other lane, like, you know, he's playing chicken with oncoming traffic. I mean, it's a very tense scene, and I think you have to have that in this movie, right? I mean, you can't have this movie about someone possessed by their car without having that scene of just crazy driving. I mean, there's not a lot of car stunts in this movie. There's less than I thought there would be, but when we get it, they're really good, and it is, I think, very, very tense. And then, of course, that sets up, you know, the final battle at Darnell's after Darnell has been killed. We get basically Dennis jumping into a bulldozer, and poor Lee, she kind of has to be the bait almost, and and she barely escapes Christine at a couple points there. But how do you guys feel about that climactic scene? The way that's staged, is that up there with the great confrontations in the Carpenter filmography, or not so much?
I think it was effective. I think it was effective in the Christine universe.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and say it is. I really enjoy the ending, and I think we get some more really terrific effects here. I mean, I don't know if I buy the fact that Dennis can just hop into this bulldozer and operate it the way he does and things of that nature, but it's kind of a cool showdown. I mean, I think Arnie's demise is pretty cool. He gets impaled on a shard of glass.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a long scene. It doesn't just like happen. Like, I mean, every time you think it's over, that it like keeps going. At least is the way that I felt.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. I mean, it's not like we're talking about that final battle in The Thing where we see the final form of the creature and MacReady just burns it with the flamethrower and says, fuck you, and that's about it. Here it is a little bit more protracted, and I like the part where Lee ends up in the office and he comes crashing through the wall of the office. This is like some of the only blood we see in the movie is when he gets impaled on that big shard of glass and has to pull it out of himself. And yeah, I mean, there's a nice weight to the bulldozer and to the car because they're using real cars. You know, again, this is not a Fast and the Furious movie. This is 1983. So, you know, we're actually going to wreck some stuff. We're going to use a real bulldozer. You're going to see metal and splinter and glass and, you know, stuff just being crushed beyond recognition. And I think that just looks and sounds really good.
Yeah. And I mean, the car just keeps coming back is like the thing, you know, like Christine just keeps regenerating itself, and that's fine, but I guess it just gets to a point where it's so damaged that it can't anymore, and that I think is, I don't know, a little cheesy. But
you know why it keeps coming back though, Chris? Because rock and roll will never die.
Oh,
the song that plays,
yes,
which is so perfect.
Gotta hate rock and roll.
I hate rock and roll. What a great line too, right? Like, you know, we've been hearing it throughout this whole movie, and like, you know, we as the viewers are thinking about, oh yeah, this juxtaposition of this 50s rock and roll music with all this carnage, oh, no pun intended, all of this
nice one, Nick Scala,
violence and
carnage,
twisted metal and broken glass and all that, and finally she just says what we've kind of been thinking there, like, all right, if we don't have to hear these 50 songs anymore, then maybe the terror is over. And I actually like the closing shots of this also. I think it's you know, it's a fun ending. It's not maybe a perfect ending, but when we see...
It's a predictable ending,
Christine
though,
kind of crushed into a cube, and then just that little twitch of metal there to suggest that, you know, maybe she's not 100% dead yet, the very horror movie thing that it does. I think that works pretty well.
Also, crushed into a cube is my self-esteem, because the song is actually Rock and Roll is Here to Stay by Danny and the Juniors, so I totally missed that landing just a minute ago.
Doesn't it go back into Bad to the Bone for the credits at the end, though?
Yeah, it does. We get that again. Josh, it's okay. You don't have to have totally encyclopedic knowledge of 50s rock and roll music. You can be on the show again. It's all right. You don't need to know everything about Buddy Holly and Dion and the Belmonts and whoever else.
I think it'd be even cooler if John Carpenter was the one that wrote Bad to the Bone. Well, but he didn't.
I'm surprised the Coupe de Villes don't appear in this movie, right? You could have like a high school dance or something, and oh, look, there's John Carpenter and Tommy Lee Wallace. And
listen, I'm here to tell you that, I mean, the music for the motion picture is great, but the electronic film score in this is awesome as well.
I like it. There's not enough of it, though. I want there to be more of it.
There's not enough of it, but in the moments where it is present, it's used very effectively. This is Carpenter and Alan Howarth again. I just did want to mention that the original film score, and this is pretty awesome.
We were listening to it prior to Nick loading up the podcast tonight, so I can confirm.
Yes, I should mention, I don't know which company, I don't have it exactly right in front of me, but this is a Carpenter score that anybody can get very inexpensively. You can go on Amazon and buy the Christine motion picture soundtrack for under $20, and it's worth it. I mean, it's you know, maybe about 35 minutes worth of music, a lot more than you get in the actual movie. But it's pretty good.
Yeah, I like his theme for this a lot. It's very melodic. It suits that scene where we're talking about the flaming car scene where Buddy gets chased down. And I think it's used really well there. And to me, I mean, some of my favorite films from the more recent era are things like Drive that take those synthesizer soundtracks and use that with this sort of car scenes and, you know, cool looking technology and stuff like that. And, you know, this almost feels a little bit like a proto version of that. And yeah, I mean, I guess it's sort of used very sparingly and very strategically in this movie because we do get all those, you know, soundtrack, those needle drops of all that classic rock and roll. But when the Carpenter stuff kicks in, that definitely gets me pumped in this movie. I like that a lot. So you're saying final thoughts. What are your guys' final thoughts? Where does this fit into the, first of all, I mean, we should place this in two different filmographies, right?
Yes.
One, how does this work as a Carpenter movie for you? Where does it sit among that canon? And two, where does this sit as far as Stephen King adaptations go? Because I think we all have at least a pretty good knowledge of films of Stephen King novels that were brought to the screen. So I'll lead that to you guys. I mean, I have some thoughts, but what are yours?
I can make this really, I'll give you my super abridged version because this is a whole nother podcast, but Christine as a movie sits for me exactly where it fits in the John Carpenter filmography as it does where it fits in the Stephen King adaptation world. It's just right in the middle. You know, I think John Carpenter has made a lot better movies. I think he's made a lot worse movies. I think there are a lot worse Stephen King adaptations. I think there are a lot better. I think this movie just kind of fits like right in the middle. I've seen some
middle of the road, the place you don't want to be running from this car. I could see that.
But I will say, I do like this movie. I like it more than I don't like it, and I can appreciate it, especially after watching the. It, like anything else, when you watch all the supplemental material and bonus material, like there was a lot of work put into this movie. The performances are pretty good. But I think what spoils it a little bit for Josh and I in particular is that the book is really so much better. It's one of those classic situations where, like, I mean, the book is, it's a long book. I mean, doing an adaptation is very difficult because, like you said, it lacks, you know, the character development and it lacks a whole treasure trove of, you know, background history that just this movie completely ignores. But I don't think it's a bad John Carpenter film, but I do have to say, up until this point, if we look at everything he's done, right? If we look at Dark Star, if we look at Assault, even movies like Someone's Watching Me and Elvis, The Thing, Escape from New York, The Fog, all of these movies. I do kind of think that this is the weakest one at this point. I don't want to go as far as to say, like, this is where we start seeing, like, cracks in his usual perfection movie making. I know Roger Ebert really liked this movie. Roger Ebert gave it a 3-star review. But this is the first movie where I'm like, it has more weaknesses than any of his other movies. And
fair
that's
enough.
Where I'll wrap it up.
Josh, what about you?
If we're talking Stephen King adaptations, I think I agree with Chris. I think this probably comes in right around the middle of Stephen King. It's not completely terrible and it's not great. So I think if probably falls there for me. I will go on record before I talk about the Carpenter portion. Chris prefaced this episode by saying I felt this was bloated, and I did until I reread it. And so I'm going to be on record forever on this to Chris saying I think this is a fantastic book. It's long, but I don't think it was as bloated as I originally thought.
I loved the book.
And I loved the hell out of this book when I read it. For Carpenter, and so here's the thing. And I never answered this in the beginning, Nick, because you said, what was my experience with Carpenter? I don't know that much about John Carpenter. Okay. For me, it's the thing, like when you guys, because you guys always ask every guest except for me tonight in terms of this actual question, when you think John Carpenter, for me, it's John Carpenter's The Thing. I know that Halloween is probably most people's favorite. I sometimes have to remind myself that that's Carpenter. Like, I don't immediately think John Carpenter with Halloween. I definitely do with The Thing, John Carpenter's Escape from New York, like those sort of things. So from what I know of Carpenter, this is probably his second worst for me.
Okay.
Yep.
No offense to Dark Star, because I enjoyed Dark Star. But it's going to be Dark Star, then it's going to be Christine. Chris saw my Letterboxd review, so he kind of had an idea of where I was going with this. I did not like this movie.
Yeah, Josh put this at a 2.5.
I gave it a 2.5, and that is solely because the music and that amazing fucking shot of Christine on fire. And my notes here that I have just says, Christine on fire fucking rules. So it was not good. I think this movie did not keep with the spirit of the book, and I'm okay with that if the adaptation is good, a la Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. I did not like this movie.
Okay. Yeah, and we should also say that like Nick's or Josh has been really cool to be listening to this podcast, because like we both watch a lot of movies and share a lot of movies with each other. I mean, he admitted to me right off the bat that he's not a huge fan of John Carpenter, but there was a lot that he hadn't seen. And the fact that he's been open-minded enough to watch all of these is great. His favorite so far is The Fog, correct?
You've
been talking very highly about
The Fog.
Yeah,
but you know me. I give those opinions to upset you and Juice and other people.
No,
so
he's just lying.
If you honestly had me rank my Carpenters, I do think The Fog is up there. Mm. Let me reserve on this in case we all get together and we get all of the guests at the end of this podcast to rank.
That's actually a really good idea. All.
We'll and just out. We all and we just all bullshit around for a bit and give final thoughts on everything. So
we are going to have to have a grand finale episode. We'll do something.
Summation. Like we have a summation episode.
So I'll say this: my top three, because you guys always give that. My top three, as I've seen them in an order that I'm not going to say is final, would be The Fog, The Thing, and Rob Zombie's Halloween.
Okay, well, that one kind of doesn't count, but I'll give you the first two.
Josh is an enormous Rob Zombie fan, and that comes up a lot. So maybe when we do the bonus episodes with Zombies Halloween.
Yeah, come on Halloween back. Maybe 2. You can sell me on those movies, because I still I'm a big fan of the original Halloween. I'm right there with you guys on Christine. I don't think it's a bad movie. I don't think there's anything particularly wrong with it. There's nothing in this movie that turns me off or that I think is stupid or really sucks. But you know, knowing what Carpenter is capable of at this point, I mean, it's definitely not one of my favorite Carpenter films. Chris, I think I'm right there with you in suggesting that maybe this is a if not his worst film to date. I mean, it's one of the most uninteresting, I think. You know, even with the TV movies, I mean, there is, like I said, there's that one scene in Someone's Watching Me that just scared the crap out of me. I didn't see it coming, and it was just beautifully set up. And
I would rather watch that movie.
Yeah, I might actually rather watch that one also. And Elvis, you know, I'm not a huge Elvis Presley fan, but that movie is well made. Kurt Russell is a lot of fun in it. This one just doesn't have the personality that those do, but I think it's a solid movie. You know, Roger Ebert gave it 3 stars, and I've read so much Roger Ebert over the years, and 3 stars is like, it's good. It's not the best thing you've ever seen, but you know, you won't feel bad about having watched it. 3 stars for Roger Ebert is basically like, yeah, why not give it a shot? You know, it's not a waste of time. There are things you like about it. Josh, I'm 100% with you. If not for that scene where Christine is on fire, chasing Buddy down the road, I think I might have a slightly less lower opinion of it. Although, you know, I'm so glad this wasn't just about people choking in a car. and then as far as Stephen King adaptations go, yeah, I would put it like middle of the road there also. You know, it's not one of my favorites. I think Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, although King himself didn't like it, that is my favorite horror movie probably. So,
Wow. Over The Exorcist?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. The Shining is an incredible movie in my eyes. And,
okay.
And I like the book a lot too, but I think it's a good adaptation. Yeah.
I didn't know this about you.
We've had this conversation, I feel like. I've sung
Shining it. Versus Exorcist? We have never had this conversation. I love The Shining, but God, come on, man.
Oh, I mean, The Exorcist is another one of my favorite horror movies. That's in the top five or so, maybe top three. But,
all right.
But as King adaptations go, I like the ones that are a little bit more character driven, like It Part One or It Chapter One, I thought did a really nice job of, you know, capturing the relationship between those kids. And I like that one a lot. I definitely like Kubrick's The Shining. The Shawshank Redemption obviously is good. I love the movie Dreamcatcher. I know it's not a very good movie. It's probably not one of his best books, but
that movie sucks.
I have a real soft spot in my heart for that one.
Well, I told you that was one of the first books that really got me into reading like in middle school. Like I have a soft place for Dreamcatcher. It's
for
fucked up.
Weasels.
Shit
weasels. That's the body horror, man. He was so obsessed.
We all
with
have
his
a soft
body.
Spot for shit weasels. Yeah,
yeah.
But I have a soft spot for Graveyard Shift, and I'm not kidding you. I know that movie is terrible, but I got it somewhere around here. I think I have it on DVD, and Brad Dourif is in that movie.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of fun adaptations of the short stories, too. Like, before we started recording, I think we were talking about The Mangler, and it's not a great movie, and it really doesn't have a whole lot to do with the Stephen King short story, but it's a pretty fun little horror movie, and Robert Englund's kind of doing his Robert Englund thing in it. I mean, you know, there's been lots of bad ones over the years, and King doesn't always translate well to the screen, and I think this one is competent. It's not...
Well, that's why Christine benefits, because there's been so many terrible adaptations.
Yeah, and this is a solid movie made by a good filmmaker, written by a good writer, and it gets the job done.
But we're in a fortunate era now, because when we were talking before we started recording, I mean, Mike Flanagan right now is just absolutely killing the Stephen King adaptations.
Nick, have you seen Dr. Sleep yet?
I have not, but I'll tell you, I didn't like that book much, but I'm still very excited to see the movie, because I think Mike Flanagan is one of the best horror directors, if not the best horror director working. So
rare instance where the movie is better than the book. I loved that movie, and...
We're in a new Stephen King renaissance right now. He's hitting his past couple of books are starting to hit a peak. I think the adaptations are going to start coming.
You get The Outsider.
Maybe
out
eventually
right now.
John Carpenter will come out of retirement, maybe take some of these to new levels. Maybe that's where we're headed.
I'd love to.
I'll tell you what's not a good Stephen King movie. Did you guys ever see Thinner?
Yes.
I'll tell you what's not a good Stephen King book, Chris. Have you ever read Thinner?
Oh, like yeah. It's Richard Bachman.
That's Richard Bachman, but... right? So we can sort of excuse that, because it's Stephen King, but it's not really Stephen King.
Yeah, but Bachman did The Long Walk, which
is
one of
the
his
Long
best
Walk,
books.
Which is probably top five Stephen King, Richard Bachman books.
I was just being an apologist, but yeah. I mean, we do. What's kind of cool now is that because television has kind of replaced movies in terms of like that's how you translate an author to the screen, a popular author like Stephen King, where you can basically capture like the entirety of like I didn't think The Outsider was that great of a book either, but I do want to check out the HBO miniseries because it's a long book and there's a lot of character development in it, and you can't do that in an hour and 40-minute movie. But you can definitely do it in like whatever it is, a 10-part miniseries. So
it's spectacular.
I will have to check it out. I would love to see, you know, Carpenter's got to make more movies. We haven't talked about that a lot on the show, but there's got to be a point where he says, all right, I am John Carpenter, master of horror. Like, he probably has a plaque that says that somewhere in his house. It's like, he's not going to just turn his back on this whole medium. So whatever that project is, I'm excited to see it. And yeah, I mean, I do think that their sensibilities do in some sense match, and we get a little bit of that in Christine, but they've both come so far since then, and I'd like to see what they can do together again.
I think that's a perfect place to wrap it up, and I gotta say, Nick, as the fanboy in the room, I'm very happy to hear that you thought this was a competent film.
It is a competent film. I was a little worried. Yeah. I mean, there's stuff that I will trash later on, I think, because I've seen some of those later Carpenter movies. But
we'll see.
You know, this is like he hasn't made anything bad at this point. He hasn't made anything where I look at it and think this movie's a piece of crap. So on that note, we would love to hear from all of you out there in Radio Land. What do you think of this movie? How do you feel about Stephen King adaptations? What would you like to see Carpenter do out of the rest of the Stephen King canon? All those many, many books that are still out there for adaptation or maybe could be rebooted. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can reach us on Gmail at precinct13podcast@gmail.com. We are on Twitter at 13precinct, facebook.com/13precinct, and our official website where you can download this episode and every episode and find all the subscription links and listen to the entirety of the show up to this point is precinct13.simplecast.com. With that, I think we're just about to head out of here. Josh, thank you so much for joining us on the show, giving us a little bit of insight into this novel. It's great having you.
Thanks, Nick. I'm sorry I dominated this, but I was very passionate about the book versus the movie.
I'm glad you had a lot to say because I didn't want to have to read a whole book leading up into doing this podcast. I just don't have time. So so I was happy that we had someone on who had read it recently and could, you know, because I had a lot of questions after seeing this movie, like we were talking about earlier about, you know, whose story it actually is and things like that and what some of the changes were. And I think that is important. And, you know, should I have been a better host and read the novel? Sure. But but I had you here, so I didn't need that. So I appreciate you being here. Thank you for being part of, like I said, the first couple of Precinct 13. And we look forward to having you back.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And by the way, I don't think that you dominated at all as far as the real estate of time spent talking. We would love to have you back, we should say, if not for anything, but to equal your better half's amount of time on the show, that which did Halloween Part 2 and The Fog. So if there's another Carpenter movie you want to do, there are still some up for grabs, and we can discuss that at a later time.
Yeah, come talk Memoirs of an Invisible Man with us, because somebody has
no
to.
No one is That's the joke of the show. That's the joke of the show.
All right. So we will talk to you. We are on to Starman from here. So a very big change in genre from one movie to the next. Have a great couple of weeks, and we will be back soon.